Chapter 6. The Role of Profits and Losses. Rockefeller got rich selling oil. He found cheaper ways to get oil from the ground to the gas pump. John Stossel. To those who run businesses, profits are obviously desirable and losses deplorable. But economics is not business administration. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, and from the standpoint of the central concern of economics, the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, profits and losses play equally important roles in maintaining and advancing the standards of living of the population as a whole. Part of the efficiency of a price-coordinated economy comes from the fact that goods can simply follow the money, without the producers really knowing just why people are buying one thing here and something else there, and yet another thing during a different season. However, it is necessary for those who run businesses to keep track not only of the money coming in from the customers, it is equally necessary to keep track of how much money is going out to those who supply raw materials, labor, electricity, and other inputs. Keeping careful track of these numerous flows of money in and out can make the difference between profit and loss. Therefore, electricity, machines, or cement cannot be used in the same careless way that caused far more of such inputs to be used per unit of output in the Soviet economy than in the German or Japanese economy. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole and the well-being of the consuming public, the threat of losses is just as important as the prospect of profits. When one business enterprise in a market economy finds ways to lower its costs, competing enterprises have no choice but to scramble to try to do the same. After the general merchandising chain Walmart began selling groceries in 1988, it moved up over the years to become the nation's largest grocery seller by the early 21st century. Its lower costs benefited not only its own customers, but those of other grocers as well. As the Wall Street Journal reported, when two Walmart supercenters and a rival regional grocery opened near a Kroger Company supermarket in Houston last year, the Kroger sales dropped 10%. Store manager Ben Bustos moved quickly to slash some prices and cut labor costs, for example, by buying ready-made cakes instead of baking them in-house and ordering pre-cut salad bar items from suppliers. His employees used to stack displays by hand. Now, fruit and vegetables arrive stacked and gleaming for display. Such moves have helped Mr. Bustos cut worker hours by 30 to 40% from when the store opened 4 years ago, and lower the prices of staples such as cereal, bread, milk, eggs, and disposable diapers. Earlier this year, sales at the Kroger finally edged up over the year before. In short, the economy operated more efficiently, to the benefit of the consumers, not only because of Walmart's ability to cut its own costs and thereby lower prices, but also because this forced Kroger to find ways to do the same. This is a microcosm of what happens throughout a free market economy. When Walmart begins selling groceries in a community, a study showed, the average price of groceries in that community falls by 6 to 12%. Similar competition by low-cost sellers in other industries tends to produce similar results in those industries. It is no accident that people in such economies tend to have higher standards of living. Profits. Profits may be the most misconceived subject in economics. Socialists have long regarded profits as simply overcharge, as Fabian socialist George Bernard Shaw called it, or a surplus value, as Karl Marx called it. "Never talk to me about profit," India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, warned his country's leading industrialist. "It is a dirty word." Philosopher John Dewey demanded that production for profit be subordinated to production for use. From all these men's perspectives, profits were simply unnecessary charges added on to the inherent costs of producing goods and services, driving up the cost to consumers. One of the great appeals of socialism, especially back when it was simply an idealistic theory without any concrete examples in the real world, was that it sought to eliminate these supposedly unnecessary charges, making things generally more affordable, especially for people with lower incomes. Only after socialism went from being a theory to being an actual economic system in various countries around the world did the fact become painfully apparent that people in socialist countries had a harder time trying to afford things that most people in capitalist countries could afford with ease and took for granted. With profits eliminated, prices should have been lower in socialist countries, according to theory, and the standard of living of the masses correspondingly higher. Why then was it not that way in practice? Profits as incentives. Let us go back to square one. The hope for profits and the threat of losses is what forces a business owner in a capitalist economy to produce at the lowest cost and sell what the customers are most willing to pay for. In the absence of these pressures, those who manage enterprises under socialism have far less incentive to be as efficient as possible under given conditions, much less to keep up with changing conditions and respond to them quickly, as capitalist enterprises must do if they expect to survive. It was a Soviet premier, Leonid Brezhnev, who said that his country's enterprise managers shied away from innovation, as the devil shies away from incense. But given the incentives of government-owned and government-controlled enterprises, why should those managers have stuck their necks out by trying new methods or new products when they stood to gain little or nothing if innovation succeeded and might have lost their jobs or worse if it failed? Under Stalin, failure was often equated with sabotage and was punished accordingly. Even under the milder conditions of democratic socialism, as in India for decades after its independence, innovation was by no means necessary for protected enterprises such as automobile manufacturing. Until the freeing up of markets that began in India in 1991, the country's most popular car was the Hindustan Ambassador, an unabashed copy of the British Morris Oxford. However, even in the 1990s, The Economist referred to the Ambassador as a barely upgraded version of a 1950s Morris Oxford. A London newspaper, The Independent, reported, "Ambassadors have for years been notorious in India for their poor finish, heavy handling, and proneness to alarming accidents." Nevertheless, there was a waiting list for the Ambassador, with waits lasting for months and sometimes years, since foreign cars were not allowed to be imported to compete with it. Under free market capitalism, the incentives work in the opposite direction. Even the most profitable business can lose its market if it doesn't keep innovating in order to avoid being overtaken by its competitors. For example, IBM pioneered in creating computers, including one 1944 model occupying 3,000 cubic feet. But in the 1970s, Intel created a computer chip smaller than a fingernail that could do the same things as that computer. Yet Intel itself was then constantly forced to improve its chips at an exponential rate as rivals like Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, Cyrix, and others began catching up with them technologically. More than once, Intel poured such huge sums of money into the development of improved chips as to risk the financial survival of the company itself. But the alternative was to allow itself to be overtaken by rivals, which would have been an even bigger risk to Intel's survival. Although Intel continued as the leading seller of computer chips in the world, continuing competition from Advanced Micro Devices spurred both companies to feverish innovation, as The Economist reported in 2007. For a while, it seemed that AMD had pulled ahead of Intel in chip design. It devised a clever way to enable chips to handle data in both 32-bit and 64-bit chunks, which Intel reluctantly adopted in 2004. And in 2005, AMD launched a new processor that split the number crunching between two cores, the brains of a chip, thus boosting performance and reducing energy consumption. But Intel came back strongly with its own dual-core designs. Next year, it will launch new chips with 8 cores on a single slice of silicon, at least a year ahead of AMD. Although this technological rivalry was very beneficial to computer users, it has had large and often painful economic consequences for both Intel and AMD. The latter had losses of more than $1 billion in 2002, and its stock lost 4/5 of its value. But 4 years later, the price of Intel stock fell by 20% in just 3 months, and Intel announced that it would lay off 1,000 managers as its profits fell by 57%, while the profits of AMD rose by 53%. All this feverish competition took place in an industry where Intel sells more than 80% of all the computer chips in the world. In short, even among corporate giants, Competition in innovation can become desperate in a free market, as the seesaw battle for market share in microchips indicates. The dean of the Yale School of Management described the computer chip industry as an industry in constant turmoil, and the chief executive officer of Intel wrote a book titled Only the Paranoid Survive. The fate of AMD and Intel is not the issue. The issue is how the consumers benefit from both technological advances and lower prices as a result of these companies' fierce competition to gain profits and avoid losses. Nor is this industry unique. In 2011, 45 of the Fortune 500 companies reported losses, totaling in the aggregate more than $50 billion. Such losses play a vital role in the economy, forcing corporate giants to change what they are doing under penalty of extinction, since no one can sustain losses of that magnitude indefinitely. Inertia may be a common tendency among human beings around the world, whether in business, government, or other walks of life, but businesses operating in a competitive market are forced by red ink on the bottom line to realize that they cannot keep drifting along like the Hindustan Motor Corporation, protected from competition by the Indian government. Even in India, the freeing of markets toward the end of the 20th century created competition in cars, forcing Hindustan Motors to invest in improvements, producing new ambassadors that were now much more reliable than their predecessors, according to the Independent newspaper, and now even had perceptible acceleration, according to the Economist magazine. Nevertheless, the Hindustan ambassador lost its long-standing position of the number one car in sales in India to a Japanese car manufactured in India, the Maruti. In 1997, 80% of the cars sold in India were Marutis. Moreover, in the now more competitive automobile market in India, Marutis too are improving, in anticipation of the next invaders, according to The Economist. As General Motors, Volkswagen, and Toyota began investing in new factories in India, the market share of Maruti dropped to 38% by 2012. There was a similar pattern in India's wristwatch industry. In 1985, the worldwide production of electronic watches was more than double the production of mechanical watches. But in India, the HMT Watch Company produced the vast majority of the country's watches, and more than 90% of its watches were still mechanical. By 1989, more than four-fifths of the watches produced in the world were electronic, but in India, more than 90% of the watches produced by HMT were still the obsolete mechanical watches. However, after government restrictions on the economy were greatly reduced, electronic watches quickly became a majority of all watches produced in India by 1993-1994, and other watch companies displaced HMT, whose market share fell to 14%. While capitalism has a visible cost, profit, that does not exist under socialism, socialism has an invisible cost, inefficiency, that gets weeded out by losses and bankruptcy under capitalism. The fact that most goods are more widely affordable in a capitalist economy implies that profit is less costly than inefficiency. Put differently, profit is a price paid for efficiency. Clearly, the greater efficiency must outweigh the profit, or else socialism would in fact have had the more affordable prices and greater prosperity that its theorists expected, but which failed to materialize in the real world. If, in fact, the cost of profits exceeded the value of the efficiency they promote, then nonprofit organizations or government agencies could get the same work done cheaper or better than profit-making enterprises, and could therefore displace them in the competition of the marketplace. Yet that seldom, if ever, happens, while the opposite happens increasingly, that is, private profit-making companies taking over various functions formerly performed by government agencies or by nonprofit organizations such as colleges and universities. While capitalists have been conceived of as people who make profits, what a business owner really gets is legal ownership of whatever residual is left over after the costs of production have been paid out of the money received from customers. That residual can turn out to be positive, negative, or zero. Workers must be paid and creditors must be paid, or else they can take legal action to seize the company's assets. Even before that happens, they can simply stop supplying their inputs when the company stops paying them. The only person whose payment is contingent on how well the business is doing is the owner of that business. This is what puts unrelenting pressure on the owner to monitor everything that is happening in the business and everything that is happening in the market for the business products or services. In contrast to the layers of authorities monitoring the actions of those under them in a government-run enterprise, the business owner is essentially an unmonitored monitor as far as the economic efficiency of the business is concerned. Self-interest takes the place of external monitors and forces far closer attention to details and far more expenditure of time and energy at work than any set of rules or authorities is likely to be able to do. That simple fact gives capitalism an enormous advantage. More important, it gives the people living in price-coordinated market economies visibly higher standards of living. It is not just ignorant people, but also highly educated and highly intellectual people like George Bernard Shaw, Karl Marx, Jawaharlal Nehru, and John Dewey, who have misconceived profits as arbitrary charges added on to the inherent costs of producing goods and services. To many people, even today, high profits are often attributed to high prices charged by those motivated by greed. In reality, most of the great fortunes in American history have resulted from someone's figuring out how to reduce costs so as to be able to charge lower prices and therefore gain a mass market for the product. Henry Ford did this with automobiles, Rockefeller with oil, Carnegie with steel, and Sears, Penny, Walton, and other department store chain founders with a variety of products. A supermarket chain in a capitalist economy can be very successful at charging prices that allow about a penny of clear profit on each dollar of sales. Because several cash registers are usually bringing in money simultaneously all day long in a big supermarket, those pennies can add up to a very substantial annual rate of return on the supermarket chain's investment, while adding very little to what the customer pays. If the entire contents of a store gets sold out in about 2 weeks, then that penny on a dollar becomes more like a quarter on the dollar over the course of a year, when that same dollar comes back to be reused 25 more times. Under socialism, that penny on each dollar would be eliminated, but so too would be all the economic pressures on the management to keep costs down. Instead of prices falling to 99 cents, they might well rise above a dollar, after the enterprise managers lose the incentives and pressures to keep production costs down. Profit rates. When most people are asked how high they think the average rate of profit is, they usually suggest some number much higher than the actual rate of profit. Over the entire period from 1960 through 2005, the average rate of return on corporate assets in the United States ranged from a high of 12.4% to a low of 4.1% before taxes. After taxes, the rate of profit ranged from a high of 7.8% to a low of 2.2%. However, it is not just the numerical rate of profit that most people misconceive. Many misconceive its whole role in a price-coordinated economy, which is to serve as incentives, and it plays that role wherever its fluctuations take it. Moreover, some people have no idea that there are vast differences between profits on sales and profits on investments. If a store buys widgets for $10 each and sells them for $15 each, some might say that it makes $5 in profits on each widget that it sells. But, of course, the store has to pay the people who work there, the company that supplies electricity to the store, as well as other suppliers of other goods and services needed to keep the business running. What is left over after all these people have been paid is the net profit, usually a lot less than the gross profit. But that is still not the same as profit on investment. It is simply net profits on sales, which still ignores the cost of investments which built the store in the first place. It is the profit on the whole investment that matters to the investor. When someone invests $10,000, what that person wants to know is what annual rate of return it will bring, whether it is invested in stores, real estate, or stocks and bonds. Profits on particular sales are not what matter most. It is the profit on the total capital that has been invested in the business that matters. That profit matters not just to those who receive it, but to the economy as a whole, because differences in profit rates in different sectors of the economy are what cause investments to flow into and out of these various sectors, until profit rates are equalized, like water seeking its own level. Changing rates of profit allocate resources in a market economy, when these are rates of profit on investment. Profits on sales are a different story. Things may be sold at prices that are much higher than what the seller paid for them, and yet, if those items sit on a shelf in the store for months before being sold, the profit on investment may be less than with other items that have less of a markup in price, but which sell out within a week. A store that sells pianos undoubtedly makes a higher percentage profit on each sale than a supermarket makes selling bread. But a piano sits in the store for a much longer time waiting to be sold than a loaf of bread does. Bread would go stale and moldy waiting for as long as a piano to be sold. When a supermarket chain buys $10,000 worth of bread, it gets its money back much faster than when a piano dealer buys $10,000 worth of pianos. Therefore, the piano dealer must charge a higher percentage markup on the sale of each piano than a supermarket charges on each loaf of bread, if the piano dealer is to make the same annual percentage rate of return on a $10,000 investment. Competition among those seeking money from investors makes profit rates tend to equalize, even when that requires different markups to compensate for different turnover rates among different products. Piano stores can continue to exist only when their higher markups in prices compensate for slower turnover in sales. Otherwise, investors would put their money elsewhere, and piano stores would start disappearing. When the supermarket gets its money back in a shorter period of time, it can turn right around and reinvest it, buying more bread or other grocery items. In the course of a year, the same money turns over many times in a supermarket, earning a profit each time, so that a penny of profit on the dollar can produce a total profit rate for the year on the initial investment equal to what a piano dealer makes, charging a much higher percentage markup on an investment that turns over much more slowly. Even firms in the same business may have different turnover rates. For example, Walmart's inventory turns over more times per year than the inventory at Target stores. In the United States in 2008, an automobile spent an average of 3 months on a dealer's lot before being sold, compared to 2 months the previous year. However, in 2008, Volkswagens sold in about 2 months in the U.S., while Chrysler's took more than 4 months. Although supermarkets tend to have especially low rates of profit on sales, because of their high rates of turnover, other businesses' profit rates on sales are also usually lower than what many people imagine. Companies that made the Fortune magazine list of the 500 largest companies in America averaged a return on revenues, sales, of a penny on the dollar in 2002, compared to 6 cents in 2000, the peak profit year. Profits on sales and profits on investment are not merely different concepts. They can move in opposite directions. One of the keys to the rise to dominance of the A&P grocery chain in the 1920s was a conscious decision by the company management to cut profit margins on sales in order to increase the profit rate on investment. With the new and lower prices made possible by selling with lower profits per item, A&P was able to attract greatly increased numbers of customers, making far more total profit because of the increased volume of sales. Making a profit of only a few cents on the dollar on sales, but with the inventory turning over nearly 30 times a year, A&P's profit rate on investment soared. This low-price and high-volume strategy set a pattern that spread to other grocery chains and to other kinds of enterprises as well. Consumers benefited from lower prices, while A&P benefited from higher profits on their investment. Further evidence that economic transactions are not a zero-sum process. In a later era, huge supermarkets were able to shave the profit margin on sales still thinner because of even higher volumes of sales, enabling them to displace A&P from industry leadership by charging still lower prices. Conversely, a study of prices in low-income neighborhoods found that there were larger-than-usual markups in prices charged their customers, but at the same time, there were lower-than-usual rates of profit on investment. Higher profits on sales helped compensate for the higher costs of doing business in low-income neighborhoods, but apparently not completely, as indicated by the avoidance of such neighborhoods by many businesses, including supermarket chains. A limiting factor in how high stores in low-income neighborhoods can raise their prices to compensate for higher costs is the fact that many low-income residents already shop in stores in higher-income neighborhoods, where the prices are lower, even though this may entail paying bus fare or taxi fare. The higher the prices rise in low-income neighborhoods, the more people are likely to shop elsewhere. Thus, stores in such neighborhoods are limited in the extent to which they can offset higher costs and slower turnover with higher prices, often leaving them in a precarious financial position, even while they are being denounced for exploiting their customers with high prices. It should also be noted that, where there are higher costs of doing business in low-income neighborhoods, when there are higher rates of crime and vandalism, such additional costs can easily overwhelm the profit margin and make many businesses unsustainable in such neighborhoods. If a store clears a penny of profit on an item that costs a quarter, then if just one out of every 25 of these items gets stolen by shoplifters, that can make it unprofitable to sell in that neighborhood. The majority of people in the neighborhood may be honest consumers who pay for what they get at the store, but it takes only a fraction as many who are shoplifters, or robbers, or vandals, to make it uneconomic for stores to locate there. Costs of production. Among the crucial factors in prices and profits are the costs of producing whatever goods or services are being sold. Not everyone is equally efficient in production, and not everyone's circumstances offer equal opportunities to achieve lower costs. Unfortunately, costs are misconceived almost as much as profits. Economies of scale. First of all, there is no such thing as the cost of producing a given product or service. Henry Ford proved long ago that the cost of producing an automobile was very different when you produced 100 cars a year than when you produced 100,000. He became the leading automobile manufacturer in the early 20th century by pioneering mass production methods in his factories, revolutionizing not only his own company, but businesses throughout the economy, which followed the mass production principles that he introduced. The time required to produce a Ford Model T chassis shrank from 12 man-hours to an hour and a half. With a mass market for automobiles, it paid to invest in expensive but labor-saving mass production machinery, whose cost per car would turn out to be modest when spread out over a huge number of automobiles. But if there were only half as many cars sold as expected, then the cost of that machinery per car would be twice as much. Large fixed costs are among the reasons for lower costs of production per unit of output as the amount of output increases. Lower costs per unit of output as the number of units increases is what economists call economies of scale. It has been estimated that the minimum amount of automobile production required to achieve the fullest economies of scale today runs into the hundreds of thousands of cars per year. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, the largest automobile manufacturer in the United States produced just 6 cars a day. At that level of output, the cost of production was so high that only the truly rich could afford to buy a car. But Henry Ford's mass production methods brought the cost of producing cars down within the price range of ordinary Americans. Moreover, he continued to improve the efficiency of his factories. The price of a Model T Ford was cut in half between 1910 and 1916. Similar principles apply in other industries. It does not cost as much to deliver 100 cartons of milk to one supermarket as it does to deliver 10 cartons of milk to each of 10 different neighborhood stores scattered around town. Economies in beer production include advertising. Although Anheuser-Busch spends millions of dollars a year advertising Budweiser and its other beers, its huge volume of sales means that its advertising cost per barrel of beer is less than that of its competitors, Coors and Miller. Such savings add up, permitting larger enterprises to have either lower prices or larger profits, or both. Small retail stores have long had difficulty surviving in competition with large chain stores charging lower prices, whether A&P in the first half of the 20th century, Sears in the second half, or Walmart in the 21st century. The higher costs per unit in the smaller stores will not permit them to charge prices as low as the big chain stores' prices. Advertising has sometimes been depicted as simply another cost added on to the costs of producing goods and services. However, insofar as advertising causes more of the advertised product to be sold, economies of scale can reduce production costs so that the same product may cost less when it is advertised rather than more. Advertising itself, of course, has costs, both in the financial sense and in the sense of using resources. But it is an empirical question, rather than a foregone conclusion, whether the costs of advertising are greater or less than the reductions of production costs made possible by the economies of scale which it promotes. This can obviously vary from one firm or industry to another. Diseconomies of scale. Economies of scale are only half the story. If economies of scale were the whole story, the question would then have to be asked, why not produce cars in even more gigantic enterprises? If General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler all merged together, would they not be able to produce cars even more cheaply and thereby make more sales and profit than when they produced separately? Probably not. There comes a point in every business beyond which the cost of producing a unit of output no longer declines as the amount of production increases. In fact, costs per unit actually rise after an enterprise becomes so huge that it is difficult to monitor and coordinate, when the right hand may not always know what the left hand is doing. Back in the 1960s, when the American Telephone and Telegraph Company was the largest corporation in the world, its own chief executive officer put it this way: AT&T is so big that if you gave it a kick in the behind today, it would be 2 years before the head said ouch. In a survey of banks around the world in 2006, The Economist magazine reported their tendency to keep growing larger and the implications of this for lower levels of efficiency. Management will find it harder and harder to aggregate and summarize everything that is going on in the bank, opening the way to the duplication of expense, the neglect of concealed risks, and the failure of internal controls. In other words, the risks inherent in banking may be well under control, as far as the top management is aware, but somewhere in their sprawling financial empire, there may be transactions being made that expose the bank to risks that the top management is unaware of. Unknown to the top management at an international bank's New York headquarters, some bank official at a branch in Singapore may be making transactions that create not only financial risks, but risks of criminal prosecution. This is not a problem peculiar to banks or to the United States. As a professor at the London Business School put it, some organizations have reached a scale and complexity that made risk management errors almost inevitable, while others had become so bureaucratic and top-heavy that they had lost the capacity to respond to changing market demands. Smaller rivals may be able to respond faster because their decision-makers do not have to go through so many layers of bureaucracy to get approval for their actions. During General Motors' long tenure as the largest manufacturer of motor vehicles in the world, its cost of production per car was estimated to be hundreds of dollars more than the costs of Ford, Chrysler, or leading Japanese manufacturers. Problems associated with size can affect quality as well as price. Among hospitals, for example, surveys suggest that smaller and more specialized hospitals are usually safer for patients than large hospitals treating a wide range of maladies. Economies of scale and diseconomies of scale can exist simultaneously in the same business at various levels of output. That is, there may be some things that a given company could do better if it were larger, and other things that it could do better if it were smaller. As an entrepreneur in India put it, what small companies give up in terms of financial clout, technological resources, and staying power, they gain in flexibility, lack of bureaucracy, and speed of decision-making. People in charge of a company's operations in Calcutta may decide what needs to be done to improve business in that city, but if they then have to also convince the top management at the company's headquarters in New Delhi, their decisions cannot be put into operation as quickly, or perhaps as fully, and sometimes the people in New Delhi may not understand the situation in Calcutta well enough to approve a decision that makes sense to people who live there. With increasing size, eventually, the diseconomies begin to outweigh the economies, so it does not pay a firm to expand beyond that point. That is why industries usually consist of a number of firms, instead of one giant, super-efficient monopoly. In the Soviet Union, where there was a fascination with economies of scale and a disregard of diseconomies of scale, both its industrial and agricultural enterprises were the largest in the world. The average Soviet farm, for example, was 10 times the size of the average American farm and employed more than 10 times as many workers. But Soviet farms were notoriously inefficient. Among the reasons for this inefficiency, cited by Soviet economists, was deficient coordination. One example may illustrate a general problem. In the vast common fields, fleets of tractors fanned out to begin the plowing. Planned fulfillment was calculated on the basis of hectares worked, and so it was to the driver's advantage to cover as much territory as quickly as possible. The drivers started by cutting deep furrows around the edge of the fields. As they moved deeper into the fields, however, they began to lift the blade of the plow and race the tractor, and the furrows became progressively shallower. The first furrows were 9 to 10 inches deep. A little farther from the road, they were 5 to 6 inches deep, and in the center of the field, where the tractor drivers were certain that no one would check on them, the furrows were as little as 2 inches deep. Usually, no one discovered that the furrows were so shallow in the middle of the field until it became obvious that something was wrong from the stunted nature of the crop. Once again, counterproductive behavior from the standpoint of the economy was not irrational behavior from the standpoint of the person engaging in it. Clearly, the tractor drivers understood that their work could be more easily monitored at the edge of a field than in the center, and they adjusted the kind and quality of work they did accordingly, so as to maximize their own pay, based on how much land they plowed. By not plowing as deeply into the ground, where they could not be easily monitored by farm officials, tractor drivers were able to go faster and cover more ground in a given amount of time, even if they covered it less effectively. No such behavior would be likely by a farmer plowing his own land in a market economy, because his actions would be controlled by the incentive of profit, rather than by external monitors. The point at which the disadvantages of size begin to outweigh the advantages differs from one industry to another. That is why restaurants are smaller than steel mills. A well-run restaurant usually requires the presence of an owner with sufficient incentives to continuously monitor the many things necessary for successful operation in a field where failures are all too common. Not only must the food be prepared to suit the tastes of the restaurant's clientele, the waiters and waitresses must do their jobs in a way that encourages people to come back for another pleasant experience, and the furnishings of the restaurant must also be such as to meet the desires of the particular clientele that it serves. These are not problems that can be solved once and for all. Food suppliers must be continuously monitored to see that they are still sending the kind and quality of produce, fish, meats, and other ingredients needed to satisfy the customers. Cooks and chefs must also be monitored to see that they are continuing to meet existing standards, as well as adding to their repertoires as new foods and drinks become popular and old ones are ordered less often by the customers. The normal turnover of employees also requires the owner to be able to select, train, and monitor new people on an ongoing basis. Moreover, changes outside the restaurant, in the kind of neighborhood around it, for example, can make or break its business. All these factors and more must be kept in mind, weighed by the owner, and continuously adjusted to if the business is to survive, much less be profitable. Such a spectrum of details, requiring direct personal knowledge and control by someone on the scene and with incentives going beyond a fixed salary, limits the size of restaurants as compared to the size of steel mills, automobile factories, or mining companies. Even where there are nationwide restaurant chains, often these are run by individual owners operating with franchises from some national organization that supplies such things as advertising and general guidance and standards, leaving the numerous on-site monitoring tasks to local owners. Howard Johnson pioneered in restaurant franchising in the 1930s, supplying half the capital, with a local manager supplying the other half. This gave the local franchisee a vested interest in the restaurant's profitability, rather than simply a fixed salary for his time. Costs and capacity. Costs vary, not only with the volume of output and varying degrees from one industry to another. They also vary according to the extent to which existing capacity is being used. In many industries and enterprises, capacity must be built to handle the peak volume, which means that there is excess capacity at other times. The cost of accommodating more users of the product or service during the times when there is excess capacity is much less than the cost of handling those who are served at peak times. A cruise ship, for example, must receive enough money from its passengers to cover not only such current costs as paying the crew, buying food, and using fuel, It must also be able to pay such overhead costs as the purchase price of the ship and the expenses at the headquarters of the cruise line. To handle twice as many passengers on a given cruise at the peak season may require buying another ship, as well as hiring another crew and buying twice as much food and fuel. However, if the number of passengers in the off-season is only one-third of what it is at the peak, then a doubling of the number of off-season passengers need not require buying another ship. Existing ships can simply sail with fewer empty cabins. Therefore, it pays the cruise line to try to attract economy-minded passengers by offering much reduced fares during the off-season. Groups of retired people, for example, can usually schedule their cruises at any time of the year, not being tied down to the vacation schedules of jobs, and usually not having young children whose school schedules would limit their flexibility. It is common for seniors to get large discounts in off-season travel, both on land and at sea. Businesses in general can afford to do this because their costs are lower in the off-season, and each particular business is forced to do it because its competitors will take customers away otherwise. Excess capacity can also result from over-optimistic building. Because of what the Wall Street Journal called an ill-timed building frenzy in luxury ships, luxury cruise lines added more than 4,000 new berths in a little over a year during the early 21st century. When they found that there was no such demand as to fill all the additional cabins at their existing prices, the net result was that Crystal Cruises, for example, offered their usual $2,995 cruise through the Panama Canal for $1,695, and Seabourn Cruise Line cut the price of its Caribbean cruise from $4,495 to $1,999. They would hardly have done this unless the pressures of competition left them no choice, and unless their incremental costs, when they had excess capacity, were lower than the reduced prices. Unutilized capacity can cause price anomalies in many sectors of the economy. In Cancun, Mexico, the cheapest room available at the modest Best Western Hotel there was $180 a night in mid-2001, while the more luxurious Ritz-Carlton nearby was renting rooms for $169 a night. The Best Western happened to be filled up, and the Ritz-Carlton happened to have vacancies. Nor was this peculiar to Mexico. A four-star hotel in Manhattan was renting rooms for less than a two-star hotel nearby, and the posh Phoenician in Phoenix was renting rooms for less than the Holiday Inn in the same city. Why were normally very expensive hotels renting rooms for less than hotels that were usually much lower in price? Again, the key was the utilization of capacity. Tourists going to popular resorts on limited budgets had made reservations at the low-cost hotels well in advance, in order to be sure of finding something affordable. This meant that fluctuations in the number of tourists would be absorbed by the higher-priced hotels. A general decline in tourism in 2001 thus led to vacancies at the luxury hotels, which then had no choice but to cut prices in order to attract more people to fill their rooms. Thus, the luxurious Boca Raton Resort and Spa in Florida gave guests their third night free, and tourists were able to get last-minute bargains on luxurious beachfront villas at Hilton Head, South Carolina, where reservations usually had to be made 6 months in advance. Conversely, a rise in tourism would also have more effect on luxury hotels, which could raise their prices even more than usual. After three consecutive years of declining profits, hotels in 2004 began yanking the discounts, as the Wall Street Journal put it, when increased travel brought more guests. The luxury hotels' reactions took the form of both price increases, $545 a night for the smallest and cheapest room at the Four Seasons Hotel in New York, and elimination of various free extras. It's already tougher this year for families to find the offers of free breakfasts and other perks that business hotels have been freely distributing for the past 3 years in an effort to fill empty beds. Because prices can vary so widely for the same room in the same hotel, according to whether or not there is excess capacity, auxiliary businesses have been created to direct travelers where they can get the best deals on a given day, Priceline and Travelocity being examples of such businesses that have sprung up to match bargain hunters with hotels that have unexpected vacancies. Since all these responses to excess capacity are due to incentives created by the prospect of profits and the threat of losses in a market economy, The same principles do not apply where the government provides a good or service and charges for it. There are few incentives for government officials to match prices with costs, and sometimes they charge more for those who create the least cost. When a bridge, for example, is built or its capacity is expanded, the costs created are essentially the costs of building the capacity to handle rush hour traffic. The cars that drive across the bridge between the morning and evening rush hours cost almost nothing because the bridge has idle capacity during those hours. Yet, when tolls are charged, often there are books of tickets or electronic passes available at lower prices per trip than the prices charged to those who drive across the bridge only occasionally during off-peak hours. Although it is the regular rush hour users who create the huge costs of building or expanding a bridge's capacity, they pay less because it is they who are more numerous voters and whose greater stake in toll policies makes them more likely to react politically to toll charges. What may seem like economic folly can be political prudence on the part of politically appointed officials operating the bridges and trying to protect their own jobs. The net economic result is that there is more bridge traffic during rush hours than if different tolls reflected costs at different times of day. Higher rush hour tolls would provide incentives for some drivers to cross the bridge either earlier or later than the rush hours. In turn, that would mean that the amount of capacity required to handle rush hour traffic would be less, reducing costs in both money terms and in terms of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Passing on costs and savings. It is often said that businesses pass on whatever additional costs are placed on them, whether these costs are placed on them by higher taxes, rising fuel costs, raises for their employees under a new union contract, or a variety of other sources of higher costs. By the same token, whatever costs come down for some reason, whether because of a tax cut or a technological improvement, for example, the question is often raised as to whether these lower costs will be passed on in lower prices to the consumers. The idea that sellers can charge whatever price they want is seldom expressed explicitly, but the implication that they can often lurks in the background of such questions as what they will pass on to their customers. But the passing on of either higher costs or savings in costs is not an automatic process, and in both cases, it depends on the kind of competition faced by each business and how many of the competing companies have the same cost increases or decreases. If you are running a gold mining company in South Africa and the government there increases the tax on gold by $10 an ounce, you cannot pass that on in higher prices to buyers of gold in the world market because gold producers in other countries do not have to pay that extra $10. To buyers around the world, gold is gold wherever it is produced. There is no way that these buyers are going to pay $10 an ounce more for your gold than for somebody else's gold. Under these circumstances, a $10 tax on your gold means that your profits on gold sales in the world market will simply decline by $10 an ounce. The same principle applies when there are rising costs of transportation. If you ship your product to market by railroad and the railroads raise their freight charges, you can pass that on to the buyers only to the extent that your competitors also ship their product by rail. But if your competitors are shipping by truck or by barge, while your location will not allow you to do the same, then raising your prices to cover the additional rail charges will simply allow your competitors, with lower costs, to take away some of your customers by charging lower prices. On the other hand, if all your competitors ship by rail and for similar distances, then all of you can pass on the higher railroad freight charges to all your customers. But if you ship your output an average of 100 miles and your competitors ship their output an average of only 10 miles, then you can raise your prices to cover the additional cost of rail charges for 10 miles and take a reduction in profit by the cost of the other 90 miles. Similar principles apply when it comes to passing on savings to customers. If you alone introduce a new technology that cuts your production costs in half, then you can keep all the additional profits resulting from these cost savings by continuing to charge what your higher-cost competitors are charging. Alternatively, and this is what has often happened, you can cut your prices and take customers away from your competitors, which can lead to even larger total profits, despite lowering your profits per unit sold. Many of the great American fortunes, by Rockefeller, Carnegie, and others, came from finding lower-cost ways of producing and delivering the product to the customer, and then charging lower prices than their higher-cost competitors could meet, thus luring away their customers. Over a period of time, competitors usually begin to use similar technological or organizational advances to cut costs and reduce prices, but fortunes can be made by pioneering innovators in the meantime. That provides incentives for enterprises and profit-seeking market economies to be on the lookout for new ways of doing things, in contrast to enterprises in either government-run economies like those in the days of the Soviet Union, or in economies where laws protect private businesses from domestic or international competition, as in India, before they began to open their economy to competition in the world market. Specialization and distribution. A business firm is limited, not only in its overall size, but also in the range of functions that it can perform efficiently. General Motors makes millions of automobiles, but not a single tire. Instead, it buys its tires from Goodyear, Michelin, and other tire manufacturers, who can produce this part of the car more efficiently than General Motors can. Nor do automobile manufacturers own their own automobile dealerships across the country. Typically, automobile producers sell cars to local people who in turn sell to the public. There is no way that General Motors can keep track of all the local conditions across the length and breadth of the United States, which determine how much it will cost to buy or lease land on which to locate an automobile dealership, or which locations are best in a given community, much less evaluate the condition of local customers' used cars that are being traded in on new ones. No one can sit in an automobile company's headquarters and decide how much trade-in value to allow on a particular Chevrolet in Seattle with some dents and scratches, or a particular used Honda in mint condition in Miami. And if the kind of salesmanship that works in Los Angeles does not work in Boston, those on the scene are likely to know that better than any automobile executive in Michigan can. In short, the automobile manufacturer specializes in manufacturing automobiles, leaving other functions to people who develop different knowledge and different skills needed to specialize in those particular functions. Middlemen. The perennial desire to eliminate the middleman is perennially thwarted by economic reality. The range of human knowledge and expertise is limited for any given person or for any manageably sized collection of administrators. Only a certain number of links in the great chain of production and distribution can be mastered and operated efficiently by the same set of people. Beyond some point, there are other people with different skills and experience who can perform the next step in the sequence more cheaply or more effectively. And therefore, at that point, it pays a firm to sell its output to some other businesses that can carry on the next part of the operation more efficiently. That is because, as we have noted in earlier chapters, goods tend to flow to their most valued uses in a free market, and goods are more valuable to those who can handle them more efficiently at a given stage. Furniture manufacturers usually do not own or operate furniture stores, and most authors do not do their own publishing, much less own their own bookstores. Prices play a crucial role in all of this, as in other aspects of a market economy. Any economy must not only allocate scarce resources which have alternative uses, it must determine how long the resulting products remain in whose hands before being passed along to others who can handle the next stage more efficiently. Profit-seeking businesses are guided by their own bottom line, but this bottom line is itself determined by what others can do and at what cost. When a product becomes more valuable in the hands of somebody else, that somebody else will bid more for the product than it is worth to its current owner. The owner then sells, not for the sake of the economy, but for the owner's own sake. However, the end result is a more efficient economy, where goods move to those who value them most. Despite superficially appealing phrases about eliminating the middleman, middlemen continue to exist because they can do their phase of the operation more efficiently than others can. It should hardly be surprising that people who specialize in one phase can do that particular phase more efficiently than others. Third world countries have tended to have more middlemen than more industrialized nations have, a fact much lamented by observers who have not considered the economics of the situation. Farm produce tends to pass through more hands between the African farmer who grows peanuts, for example, to the company that processes it into peanut butter than would be the case in the United States. A similar pattern was found with consumer goods moving in the opposite direction. Boxes of matches may pass through more hands between the manufacturer of matches and the African consumer who ultimately buys them. A British economist in mid-20th century West Africa described and explained such situations there. West African agricultural exports are produced by tens of thousands of Africans operating on a very small scale and often widely dispersed. They almost entirely lack suitable storage facilities, and they have no or only very small cash reserves. The large number and the long line of intermediaries in the purchase of export produce essentially derive from the economies to be obtained from bulking very large numbers of small parcels. In produce marketing, the first link in the chain may be the purchase, hundreds of miles from Kano, of a few pounds of groundnuts, which after several stages of bulking arrive there as part of a wagon or lorry load of several tons. Instead of 10 farmers in a given area all taking time off from their farming to carry their individually small amounts of produce to a distant town for sale, one middleman can collect the produce of the many farmers and drive it all to a produce buyer at one time, allowing these farmers to apply their scarce resources, time and labor, to the alternative uses of those resources for growing more produce. Society as a whole thus saves on the amount of resources required to move produce from the farm to the next buyer, as well as saving on the number of individual negotiations required at the final points of sale. This saving of time is especially important during the harvest season, when some of the crop may become overripe before it is picked, or spoil afterwards if it is not picked promptly and then gotten into a storage or processing facility quickly. In a wealthier country, each farm would have more produce, and motorized transport on modern highways would reduce the time required to get it to the next point of sale, so that the time lost per ton of crop would be less and fewer middlemen would be required to move it. Moreover, modern farmers in prosperous countries would be more likely to have their own storage facilities, harvesting machinery, and other aids. What is and is not efficient, either from the standpoint of the individual farmer or of society as a whole, depends on the circumstances. Since these circumstances can differ radically between rich and poor countries, very different methods may be efficient in each country, and no given method need be right for both. For similar reasons, there are often more intermediaries between the industrial manufacturer and the ultimate consumer in poor countries. However, the profits earned by each of these intermediaries is not just so much waste, as often assumed by third-party observers, especially observers from a different society. Here, the limiting factor is the poverty of the consumer, which restricts how much can be bought at one time. Again, West Africa in the mid-20th century provided especially clear examples. Imported merchandise arrives in very large consignments and needs to be distributed over large areas to the final consumer, who, in West Africa, has to buy in extremely small quantities because of his poverty. The organization of retail selling in Ibadan and elsewhere exemplifies the services rendered by petty traders both to suppliers and to consumers. Here there is no convenient central market, and it is usual to see petty traders sitting with their wares at the entrances to the stores of the European merchant firms. The petty traders sell largely the same commodities as the stores, but in much smaller quantities. This might seem to be the ideal situation in which to eliminate the middleman, since the petty traders were camped right outside stores selling the same merchandise, and the consumers could simply walk right on past them to buy the same goods inside at lower prices per unit. But these traders would sell in such tiny quantities as 10 matches or half a cigarette, while it would be wasteful for people in the stores behind them to spend their time breaking down their packaged goods that much, in view of the better-paying alternative uses of their labor and capital. The alternatives available to the African petty traders were seldom as remunerative, so it made sense for these traders to do what it would not make sense for the European merchant to do. Moreover, it made sense for the very poor African consumer to buy from the local traders, even if the latter's additional profit raised the price of the commodity, because the consumer often could not afford to buy the commodity in the quantities sold by the European merchants. Obvious as all this may seem, it has been misunderstood by renowned writers, and, worse yet, by both colonial and post-colonial governments, hostile to middlemen, and prone to creating laws and policies expressing that hostility. Socialist economies. As in other cases, one of the best ways of understanding the role of prices, profits, and losses is to see what happens in their absence. Socialist economies not only lack the kinds of incentives which force individual enterprises toward efficiency and innovation, they also lack the kinds of financial incentives that lead each given producer in a capitalist economy to limit its work to those stages of production and distribution at which it has lower costs than alternative enterprises. Capitalist enterprises buy components from others who have lower costs in producing those particular components, and sell their own output to whatever middleman can most efficiently carry out its distribution. But a socialist economy may forego these advantages of specialization, and for perfectly rational reasons, given the very different circumstances in which they operate. In the Soviet Union, for example, many enterprises produced their own components, even though specialized producers of such components existed and could manufacture them at lower costs. Two Soviet economists estimated that the costs of components needed for a machine-building enterprise in the USSR were 2 to 3 times as great as the costs of producing those same components in specialized enterprises. But why would cost matter to the individual enterprise making these decisions in a system where profits and losses were not decisive? What was decisive was fulfilling the monthly production quotas set by government authorities, and that could be assured most readily by an enterprise making its own components, since it could not depend on timely deliveries from other enterprises that lacked the profit and loss incentives of a supplier in a market economy. This was not peculiar to machine-building enterprises. According to the same Soviet economists, the idea of self-sufficiency in supply penetrates all the tiers of the economic administrative pyramid from top to bottom. Just over half the bricks in the USSR were produced by enterprises that were not set up for that purpose, but which made their own bricks in order to build whatever needed building to house their main economic activity. That was because these Soviet enterprises could not rely on deliveries from the Ministry of the Industry of Construction Materials, which had no financial incentives to be reliable in delivering bricks on time or of the quality required. For similar reasons, far more Soviet enterprises were producing machine tools than were specifically set up to do so. Meanwhile, specialized plants set up for that purpose worked below their capacity, which is to say, at higher production costs per unit than if their overhead had been spread out over more units of output, because so many other enterprises were producing these machine tools for themselves. Capitalist producers of bricks or machine tools have no choice but to produce what is wanted by the customer, and to be reliable in delivering it, if they intend to keep those customers in competition with other producers of bricks or machine tools. That, however, is not the case when there is one nationwide monopoly of a particular product under government control, as was the situation in the Soviet Union. In China's economy as well, when it was government planned for decades after the communists took over in 1949, many enterprises supplied their own transportation for the goods they produced, unlike most companies in the United States that pay trucking firms or rail or air freight carriers to transport their products. As the Far Eastern Economic Review put it, through decades of state-planned development, nearly all big Chinese firms transported their own goods, however inefficiently. Although theoretically firms specializing in transportation might operate more efficiently, the absence of financial incentives for a government monopoly enterprise to satisfy their customers made specialized transport enterprises too unreliable, both as to times of delivery and as to the care or lack of care when handling goods in transit. A company manufacturing television sets in China might not be as efficient in transporting those sets as a specialized transport enterprise would be, but at least they were less likely to damage their own TV sets by handling them roughly in transit. One of the other side effects of unreliable deliveries has been that Chinese firms have had to keep more goods in inventory, foregoing the advantages of just-in-time delivery practices in Japan, which reduced the Japanese firm's costs of maintaining inventories. Dell Computers in the United States likewise operates with very small inventories relative to their sales, but this is possible only because there are shipping firms like Federal Express or UPS that Dell can rely on to get components to them and computers to their customers quickly and safely. The net result of habits and patterns of behavior left over from the days of a government-run economy is that China spends about twice as high a share of its national income on transportation as the United States does, even though the U.S. has a larger territory, including two states separated by more than 1,000 miles from the other 48 states. Contrasts in the size and therefore costs of inventories can be extreme from one country to another. Japan carries the smallest inventories, while the Soviet Union carried the largest, with the United States in between. As two Soviet economists pointed out, spare parts are literally used right off the truck. In Japan, producers commonly deliver supplies to their ordering companies 3 to 4 times a day. At Toyota, the volume of warehoused inventories is calculated for only an hour of work, while at Ford, the inventories are for up to 3 weeks. In the Soviet Union, these economists said, "We have in inventories almost as much as we create in a year." In other words, most of the people who work in Soviet industry could take a year's paid vacation, and the economy could live on its inventories. This is not an advantage, but a handicap, because inventories cost money and don't earn any. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, the production of inventory uses up resources without adding anything to the standard of living of the public. As the Soviet economists put it, "Our economy is always burdened by the heavy weight of inventories, much heavier than those that weigh on a capitalist economy during the most destructive recessions." Yet the decisions to maintain huge inventories were not irrational decisions, given the circumstances of the Soviet economy and the incentives and constraints inherent in those circumstances. Soviet enterprises had no real choice but to maintain these costly inventories. The less reliable the suppliers, the more inventory it pays to keep, so as not to run out of vital components. Nevertheless, inventories add to the costs of production, which add to the price, which in turn reduces the public's purchasing power and therefore its standard of living. Geography can also increase the amount of inventory required. As a result of severe geographical handicaps that limit transportation in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, large inventories of both agricultural produce and industrial output have had to be maintained there because regions heavily dependent on rivers and streams for transportation can be cut off if those rivers and streams fall too low to be navigable because the rainy season is either delayed or ends prematurely. In short, geographic handicaps to land transportation and drastic differences in rainfall at different times of the year add huge inventory costs in sub-Saharan Africa, contributing to that region's painfully low standard of living. In Africa, as elsewhere, maintaining large inventories means using up scarce resources without a corresponding addition to the consumer's standard of living. The reason General Motors can produce automobiles without producing any tires to go on them is because it can rely on Goodyear, Michelin, and whoever else supplies their tires to have those tires waiting to go on the cars as they move down off the production lines. If those suppliers failed to deliver, it would, of course, be a disaster for General Motors, but it would be even more catastrophic for the tire companies themselves. To leave General Motors high and dry, with no tires to go on its Cadillacs or Chevrolets, would be financially suicidal for a tire company, since it would lose a customer for millions of tires each year, quite aside from the billions of dollars in damages from lawsuits over breach of contract. Under these circumstances, it is hardly surprising that General Motors does not have to produce all its own components, as many Soviet enterprises did. Absurd as it might seem to imagine Cadillacs rolling off the assembly lines and finding no tires to go on them, back in the days of the Soviet Union, one of that country's own high officials complained that hundreds of thousands of motor vehicles stand idle without tires. The fact that complex coordination takes place so seemingly automatically in one economic system that people hardly even think about it does not mean that coordination will be similarly automatic in another economic system operating on different principles. Ironically, it is precisely where there is no one controlling the whole economy that it is automatically coordinated by price movements, while in deliberately planned economies, a similar level of coordination has repeatedly turned out to be virtually impossible to achieve. Reliability is an inherent accompaniment of the physical product. When keeping customers is a matter of economic life and death under capitalism, whether at the manufacturing level or the retail level. Back in the early 1930s, when refrigerators were just beginning to become widely used in the United States, there were many technological and production problems with the first mass-produced refrigerators sold by Sears. The company had no choice but to honor its money-back guarantee by taking back 30,000 refrigerators at a time when Sears could ill afford to do so, in the depths of the Great Depression, when businesses were as short of money as their customers were. This situation put enormous financial pressure on Sears to either stop selling refrigerators, which is what some of its executives and many of its store managers wanted, or else greatly improve their reliability. What they eventually did was improve the reliability of their refrigerators, thereby becoming one of the leading sellers of refrigerators in the country.